This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 10th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Section D on Monocle 24 in association with Squarespace. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's design show. I'm Sophie Grove. First up, we're in Singapore for a glimpse of this year's World Architecture Festival.
Imagine a series of high-rise residential towers. Imagine somebody chops them up, stacks them, and then puts each one at a different angle.
Then we'll take a step back from the hype for a considered look at post-war buildings here in England.
There was no attempt to really explain what modern architecture in particular was all about, and the reassessment is only now taking place.
And later in the show, we'll hear from some long-standing East London manufacturers who are bucking the trend of constant change that's come to define their neighbourhood. All that and plenty more besides, right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Starting off things today, we're touching down in Singapore, where the World Architecture Festival wrapped up last Friday. Among the proceedings were no less than 338 visionary projects spanning 46 countries, making up this year's shortlist. Monocle's Rachel Mui was just one of the curious onlookers eager to capture some of the highlights on display. She sent us this report.
I'm here at the Marina Bay Sands Expo and Convention Centre, where the World Architecture Festival is being held this year. The World Architecture Festival is the world's largest festival dedicated to celebrating architectural excellence from across the globe, with its awards becoming increasingly coveted amongst architects worldwide. And with me here, I have Paul Finch, Programme Director and Founder of the World Architecture Festival.
Well, it was a very mixed range as usual, because people have to compete in 17 different categories. We have a two-day judging process, after which we have 17 winners. And the 17 winners then have to present again to a kind of super jury on the final day of the festival. And of those 17, we then name the completed World Building of the Year. This year, the project is in Singapore. It's the Interlace Housing Project, originally by the architects OMA, but then their design partner formed his own practice, Ole Sheeran, and they were successful. It's a big project for Capita Land, and for those of you who know Interlace, imagine a series of high-rise residential towers. Imagine somebody chops them up, stacks them, and then puts each one at a different angle. So this is an extraordinary looking building, but it's very interesting because it keeps people nearer to the ground, and it allows all sorts of interesting spaces between buildings and within parts of buildings where they intersect, which can create roof gardens, gardens at different levels, of course gardens at the base of the building, pools, sporting areas. So really rather a delightful place for the residents. And the judges thought that this was a really powerful architectural idea, which will be able to be used in different ways by all sorts of people in all sorts of situations where you didn't want, for example, to have a series of tightly packed high-rise towers and where you were looking for a different way of doing things.
Absolutely. And do you think there were any key elements or criteria that the judges looked out for this year?
The judges are looking for schemes that are excellent in an all-round sort of way. And of course, projects are very different depending on their size, their scale, what climate they're being designed for. But in a way, what the judges do is they look at the intelligence with which the architect has approached the task. Has it been successfully achieved? Was their ambition a sensible ambition? And if it was, how successful have they been in achieving it? And that's how you can compare, for example, whether a house might be a better piece of architecture than a huge office block, even though it's tiny by comparison. And of course, an office block could very easily be better than a house, even though some people would find it big and forbidding.
This year's winner for the World Building of the Year is The Interlace by OMA Ole Sheeran. I've managed to track down Eric Cheng, one of the architects involved in the project, who shared with me his thoughts about what made The Interlace stand out.
I think there is something maybe very fitting about the project, and what I'm happy about is maybe that the jury and WAF recognized maybe this project, not necessarily for its architecture per se, but for it being maybe kind of a prototype or a model for looking at social connectivity and building a sense of community and providing a real diversity of experience, a kind of experience-based design. There are many other projects that also do that, so I'm not saying that ours does it more than others, but I think there's also something maybe fitting about this being a project in Singapore and the World Architecture Festival being in Singapore this year.
Lastly, we catch up with Professor Jason Pomeroy, founding principal of eco-design firm Pomeroy Studio, to find out more about where the Singapore architecture industry is headed.
I think we need to bear in mind that Singapore is an island that's kind of spatially constrained from the outset. And so I think it's important to not only balance the opportunities for built environment professionals like ourselves who undertake master planning services or landscape design or architecture or interior design or graphic design or even sustainability consultancy, to not just be rooted in one place, but to look at Singapore as a hub. What I think is quite remarkable about Singapore is that it's so well strategically placed to be able to serve a broader realm. And so I'm kind of fortunate enough to be able to look slightly further afield out of the little red dot to Malaysia, Philippines, Indonesia, and then all the way through to the Middle East. And I think that the infrastructure in Singapore is such that it does provide those opportunities to be able to reach outside. And I guess it's for that reason that Singapore is incredibly resilient and will certainly be making an active contribution to the built environment industry and the design industry for the very near future.
Rachel Mui there, perusing some of the offerings at this year's World Architecture Festival in Singapore. You're listening to Section D with me, Sophie Grove. Post-war architecture in England is a topic often misunderstood. The era of Breton Brut has been much maligned. In fact, many buildings from the 50s, 60s and 70s are beautiful, pioneering structures with a growing fan club. Elaine Harwood is a leading expert on the topic. Together with an award-winning photographer, James O. Davies, the pair have spent the last 18 years, on and off, creating a new book profiling some of England's post-war listed buildings. From the Barbican in London to humble prefabs and even telephone boxes, the book is a guided tour through some of the city's idiosyncrasies. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco caught up with Elaine here at Midori House.
Before we talk about the book and the buildings itself, can you just describe to us what's English architecture post-war? Can you give us the main characteristics of this period?
Oh, gosh, well, there was a lot of rebuilding needed after wartime bombing and shortages. So you see a whole new light style. Quite austere, because obviously there wasn't a lot of money or materials around after the war. So the first buildings tend to be brick or prefabricated, but rather skinny and simple, a little bit influenced by Sweden, and looking at kind of quite picturesque characteristics. So although they're much simpler than styles like Art Deco that your readers or listeners will know, there's something rather elegant about them. And as more money became available and steel and concrete appeared in larger supplies, so buildings got heavier to cope with bigger offices and car parking and central heating, all the things that we take for granted now, but which were terribly new. And buildings like big offices and shopping centres start to appear in the 60s. And those much heavier buildings are what a lot of people say they don't like. And yet they're the sort of infrastructure of our cities today.
And I mean, you mentioned about those big buildings and everything, but what's interesting about the book, that is very diverse. I mean, you have a telephone box, a cathedral, and the Barbican, let's say, for example. So it's quite a varied period as well.
Very much so, because so much was needed after the war. And there's also new building types, such as buildings for aircraft and the motor car. The AA boxes that you mention seem sort of terribly quaint now, but in the 1950s, when driving was new, somewhere where you could call a special dedicated breakdown service was terrifically important.
I know that's a terribly difficult question, but do you have a favourite building, I mean, that speaks to you emotionally, perhaps?
I do. Which one? Think so. There's lots of choice, of course, with so many. But I think the engineering building at Leicester University, a lot of people don't realise just how higher education expanded after the war. Leicester had something like 81 students in 1939. It was only the relatively wealthy people would really go to university unless there was a special scholarship for them. And that sector expanded hugely after 1945. But what I love about Leicester Engineering Building is that it's quite brutal looking. It's made of concrete. It's very expressive, however, and it's clad in red bricks, which sort of link it to the old Victorian buildings of the city. And Leicester's paramount, a red brick city. And this relatively tall but rather slinky, elegant building coming up out of the rooftops across a park with lots of red brick, however, and lots of gravy glass roofs just really inspires me.
Another interesting topic, even our design editor, Josh Fennett, he wrote about your book on our October issue, is that a lot of those buildings were misunderstood. And we're just talking before the interview, and you said that they're still misunderstood, some of them. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
I suppose there was a reaction against modern architecture in the 1970s and 1980s. A lot of buildings weren't maintained. Now, there was a belief that this was a new architecture that didn't need maintenance. And then local authorities or institutions in charge of repairing buildings didn't have the money. So a lot of buildings looked very bedraggled. But I think there was no attempt to really explain what architecture in general, and modern architecture in particular, was all about. And a lot of people believed Prince Charles when he declared a lot of these buildings to be ugly. And a reassessment is only now taking place.
That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco there in conversation with Elaine Harwood. Still to come on Section D, we'll get an up-close look at an exhibition celebrating the unseen work of a renowned French designer. A little later, we'll head to East London. This is Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove.
Great design tells stories, and Squarespace's innovative website building tool is the perfect platform from which to tell them beautifully. Showcase your creativity, ideas, and business in style with Squarespace's unrivaled range of online products and services. To see how it could work for you and for a 10% discount, head to squarespace.com and enter the promotion code Monocle. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
You're listening to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. Off to Paris now, where the Galerie Perrotin is alight with visual flair thanks to a new exhibition, Paulin, Paulin, Paulin. Running until the 19th of December, it offers an insight into the modernist furniture designer Pierre Paulin's work, which is now produced in limited editions by the family's firm, Paulin, Paulin, Paulin. The firm was founded in 2008 and aims to promote the designer's work by producing pieces that never got beyond the prototype stage. For those unfamiliar with Pierre Paulin's work, he was most famous for his innovative designs during the 1960s. His early collections in the 1950s leaned towards Scandinavian modernism. In the 60s and 70s, he was playful, and by the end of his career, nearly 60 years later, he explored a more architectural, structured style of furniture, like the amorphic pieces commissioned for French President François Mitterrand. Pierre Paulin's son, Benjamin, and his partner, Alice Lemoine, joined Monocle's Daphne Hazard in Gallery Emmanuel Perrotin to tell us more.
The mission of Paulin is not to re-edit some models, but to edit for the first time. So we decided to present the Déclive, which was initially prototyped in 66 by my father and never edited, unfortunately. So this is the first presentation of this edition in Paris and in the world. And we also present the first edition of some model we prototyped with Louis Vuitton in Miami last year. And for the first time also, an edition of the ensemble of rugs and armchairs and table of the Palais d'Iéna, which was a command from the Ministère de la Culture in 85 for my father. So this is also the first edition.
Just to go back in the past and to retell the story, you have a structure called Paulin. And you did this exhibition in Miami a year ago. Was that the kickoff? What's going on now?
The Paulin editions has just started with the Louis Vuitton collaboration, but the idea of limited edition has already started during Pierre Paulin's life, because in the 80s he started to do limited edition and he was one of the first designer to work this way, much before Renard or other.
He's always been a visionary. Exactly. He's always been very modern in his furniture, but also in his ideas. Yeah.
This is the very funny thing, because when my father was made all those very modular system, very avant-garde model in the 60s and in the 70s, he also did the same in the 80s. Like Alice said, when he made for the first time limited edition from designers and everybody's, it was at Musée des Arts Décoratifs in 84. Four or three, and everybody was like, it will never work. And now you can see all around the world, all the fair with the same kinds of design, precious materials, limited edition. It's very funny because all his career was very visionary. So
to complete the Paulin mission, it has started before we worked on the limited edition, because the aim of Paulin is first of all to develop the knowledge. And Maya Paulin has worked a lot to make the exhibition at Centre Pompidou happening. All this cultural movement around Pierre Paulin has started long time ago.
How do you explain this boom you were talking about? Is it the 60s and 70s period is still very popular?
The boom of the 60s and 70s, for us, it's a good opportunity, but we are working to make sure that the Pierre Paulin's name will not just stay for this boom. We don't want a fashion event, fashion trend. We want to take advantage of this global movement, because the 70s are in fashion, art, 70s are everywhere now, but we want to make sure that the name will follow, will survive after this trend period. And honestly, we think we are on the good way, because even if we are in the boom of the 70s, the cover of the magazine Le Monde 2 a few weeks ago was with the daybed of Pierre Paulin made in the 50s. So it was not presenting Pierre Paulin with the 70s eyes, but with the 50 furniture. And no, he was associated to Perriand and Prouvé. Mainly knows much before.
This is very important for us, because we are trying to make all his career more known. Yeah. So the 50s was not very well known from his work. So this is a good thing that now people are saying the name Paulin near to Perriand and to Prouvé.
That was Pierre Paulin's son, Benjamin, and his partner, Alice, talking to Monocle's Daphne Hazel. In recent years, East London has become a voguish stomping ground for a new generation of inner-city makers. But a new book, entitled Makers of East London, reveals that there's also an array of time-tested businesses still plying their trade in this corner of the city. The beautifully shot tome is both a rundown of 26 East London manufacturers and a snapshot of this creative quarter's diversity and charm, from violin and bell makers to spoon whittlers and spectacle shapers. The book's writer, Katie Tregidden, and Bow-based Kyla McCallum of design studio Foldability join Monocle's Josh Fennett here at Midori House to tell us more.
So Hoxton Mini Press specialise in books about East London, and the book was actually their idea. They'd noticed this sort of revolution of making in East London, and it was something they wanted to investigate. So they met me and realised that I wrote about design and had a particular interest in sort of craft and making, and asked me if I'd be interested in writing it. And of course, I leapt at the chance.
Well, you say kind of revolution, but I think, you know, many of these companies are quite, you know, they're in long-held berths. I mean, Whitechapel Bell Foundry, I think, are the people that did Big Ben itself. I mean, some of these companies are kind of age old. So when you started putting together the book and when you started actually meeting these people, did you realise that it's maybe not as new a trend as it seems? Or, you know, what was it like?
Yeah, I mean, East London has a huge heritage of making, particularly cabinet making and furniture making, and of course the what's called the rag trade, so sort of fashion and textiles. But I think most people think that's gone. There's this idea that we don't make anything in England anymore, let alone in London. And I knew of up-and-coming designers like Kyla and people like Barn the Spoon, who are very much sort of part of that new maker revolution. I was actually less aware of the people who are still making and have been making continuously since sort of East London's heyday as a manufacturing hotspot.
So Kyla, if we bring you in here, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your business and give us a bit of insight into, you know, what it's like to be one of the people covered in this book, but also what it's like to and what it means to, you know, make things within the city that you live in.
Well, my business is called Foldability, so I make origami-inspired products, mainly lighting, but also a bit of set design, fashion, and sort of branching out into different areas, but everything's to do with origami. So in East London, I moved down to London from Scotland with the idea that there would be more sort of opportunities and different avenues to sort of take my business. But what I found actually is there are a lot of makers, but it is quite a struggle to sort of remain in the area. And I think the way that people do it is by doing lots of different things. Maybe not the longer, bigger companies who've been there for quite a long time. But yeah, certainly the individual makers, I think, have a lot of avenues and streams to their business, which maybe is a bit of a difference from in the past. It was maybe people did one thing and really stuck to that one piece of making.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we look at the book, I mean, it's clearly a celebratory book. It's beautifully shot and it's written in a kind of, in a very celebratory tone. But I wonder, you know, is the book preserving a piece of what we're seeing in East London now? Or is it an elegy for the fact that, you know, people won't always be able to make in the city? Or do you think there's hope for people to keep manufacturing as rents go up and as it becomes more expensive to do so?
I think there really is hope. And one of the things I talk about in the introduction is the fact that East London has always been a place of change. The Huguenots came in escaping religious persecution and bought the weaving trade. And then the Jews arrived, again escaping religious persecution as the Huguenots were leaving. And there's constantly been one creative group moving in as another creative group are moving out. And at the moment, it's manufacturing that's under pressure because space is expensive. So anything that requires a lot of space is very difficult to do in London now. But there are lots of things popping up. So there are shared workspaces and there are people sort of fusing traditional manufacturing methods with contemporary manufacturing methods that require less space. And I think what's exciting about East London is it's dynamic, it's always changing, and it's full of innovators. And innovators will find solutions to these problems. So I think East London will always have a vibrant creative hub. What that looks like will keep changing, and that's kind of what's exciting about it.
So if we were to dive under the covers of the book and take a look at some specific examples, I mean, we have spoon whittlers, we have globe makers. What were the most interesting people, or maybe the strangest discoveries you made while you were researching the book and reporting it?
Do you know, I think absolutely every one of the makers in this book was absolutely fascinating. I could have written a book about each of them. And, you know, my first drafts for each chapter were much, much longer than where we ended up. But it was, I mean, there were some lovely stories in there. Sebastian Tarek, you mentioned, the shoemaker, was studying shoemaking, and he went to visit his Polish grandma, and she said, "Oh, your grandfather would be proud." And Sebastian said, really, did he like shoes? And she said, no, he was a shoemaker, you idiot. And it turns out he's got like 15 generations of shoemakers in his family that he had no idea about. And he'd just been somehow drawn to this family tradition without even realising. And then Barn the Spoon, you mentioned, is a real character. And he'd done all sorts of things in woodwork and was going through a time in his life when, you know, stuff wasn't really working out for him. He was going through a really rough patch. And he thought, you know what, one thing that is good is carving spoons. So I'm just going to keep carving spoons. Like, that's the only thing right now that's working for me. And I'm just going to carve spoons and carve spoons and carve spoons until something good comes out of it. And now he's, you know, that's what he does for a living. And he's probably the most famous spoon carver in the woodworking world. So I was really inspired by sort of these stories of passion and dedication and hard work of people who are, you know, often surviving against the odds in London.
I don't, but I love it. Would that we could all solve our problems by carving a simple spoon. And Kyla, if we come back to you, do you feel, I mean, the interesting thing to me about this is, you know, for the magazine and, you know, through the radio, we do cover a lot of makers and people doing interesting things. Is there, you know, when you see all of these things side by side, a sense of community amongst these people, a sense of shared struggle, a sense of shared, you know, independence in, you know, basically having to forge your own way in quite a difficult industry in a city that's, if we're being honest, makes it very hard for you to do so.
Definitely. It's funny that a lot of the makers in the book I hadn't heard of before, and now I keep banging into them and like seeing them at trade shows, and it really makes London feel a lot smaller, and a lot of my friends know another maker that's in the book, and yeah, it's really good to, and important for me to have that sense of community and know that other people are in the same boat. And it's a struggle doing it on your own sometimes, and you need to have other people that understand the experience that it is to set up a business in London. And so, yeah, it's definitely important.
And I wonder if that was that maybe part of what you were doing for the book as well, trying to create a united kind of vision and idea of what was going on and distill a single moment into a book, or did that come later?
I think that came later. I think it was a sense of realising what these very different makers had in common. I mean, as you say, we talked to everybody from Whitechapel Bell Foundry and people who are often doing the job their parents did, and it's a making job, it's not a design job, right through to people like Kyla who design their own products and are running their own businesses. So they're very different people in the book. But actually what I found quite interesting was in talking to them, they all had a shared passion and a shared love of what they do. Steve McEwen, who makes the bells at Whitechapel Bell Foundry, said he was born to make things. And this is someone who fell into this job. You know, he did an apprenticeship making bagpipes in Scotland. And then when his family moved to London, his wife applied for this job for him and didn't tell him until he got an interview. So, I mean, it's not like he planned this career, but he said, you know, he was born to make things with his hands and he doesn't feel happy unless he does. So there was this lovely sort of sense of continuity between all these very different people, I guess, united by a passion and a love of making. And I think there's something quite innate. Barn the Spoon talks about it in the book. He says, you know, making things with axes is in our blood. And I think there is something quite innate about making things with your hands that we're in danger of losing as a society as things become more digital and more remote. And I think what's quite nice about this book is it reminds people of that and connects people to that as well as to each other.
That was Katie Tregidden and Kyla McCallum of design studio Foldability chatting to Monocle's Josh Fennett. And that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D. We'll be back at the same time next week. And of course, if you missed any of this week's show or our back catalogue, you can always head to monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes for another listen. This show was put together by Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or questions, send us an email at info@monocle.com. I'm Sophie Grove. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.